house announcements. And so now, it is my great pleasure to introduce Sharon Salzberg. Many of you have probably practiced with Sharon or have known Sharon for many years. Sharon is one of the leading teachers of meditation in North America. She wandered off to India in the early 70s did her first meditation retreat in Bodh Gaya, where the Buddha was enlightened, in 1971. And after 2 or 3 years of practice there, she returned to the United States, and her teacher told her to go back to the U.S. and to teach. So in 1974, she came back to the U.S. and Naropa at the in Boulder at the Naropa Institute, their first summer festival they had, where she teamed up with Joseph Goldstein and Jack Kornfield, and those three names have been associated with each other ever since. A year or two later, they founded the Insight Meditation Society in central Massachusetts. I had the great fortune of living there for 15 years and running the place, and lived there with my wife, Myoshin. And I think it was around about when I first came there in 94. That was just before Loving Kindness, your first book, was published. I remember there was lots of excitement about it. So Sharon's first book was published in the mid-90s, Loving Kindness. I can't remember the full title.
The Revolutionary Art of Happiness.
Yes. And then since then, she's been a prolific author and has written a number of books, including a year or two ago, a very popular book that was on the New York Times best-selling list. And the title was Real Happiness, The Power of Meditation, a 28-day program. And so we have copies of that and all of Sharon's books. Some of the other titles you might be familiar with, The Kindness Handbook, Force of Kindness, Faith, Trusting Your Own Deepest Experience, and A Heart as Wide as the World. I actually remember Myoshin was the one that came up with the title for that, was she not?
She was the one who came up with the title for that.
So you can see Myoshin, my wife, and I have had a long and delightful relationship with Sharon over the last couple of decades. So I think you now live mostly in New York, and, and between New York and Barrie, and travels and teaches quite a bit. It's at least a decade since you were here in the Twin Cities, around about?
I think 2003, probably.
Yeah, that's a decade. Years. Yeah, wow. So anyway, it's my great pleasure to welcome Sharon to the Twin Cities, and thank you so much for coming here, and we're really delighted that you're here and looking forward and welcoming you to this, our community. Thank you very much, Sharon.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. How many of you were not at the gathering last night? Okay. I can tell the same story. Which is that I was last here. I was here 2 years in a row, 2002-2003, when my book Faith came out, and the publisher of that book sent me on a book tour, and first hardcover and then paperback, and each book tour included Minneapolis. So that was the last time I was here. And then, I can't remember exactly what it was, Edwin was visiting the Insight Meditation Society in Barrie, and he said, why don't you come to Minneapolis? So it really, the invitation was from him, and I was so happy at the thought. I see this morning I've already been in 3 places, Minneapolis, Cleveland, and St. Paul. And the joke, although apparently it's true, is every time I ask somebody, how long is it going to take us to get from here to there, They always say 15 to 20 minutes. Wherever it is, it's kind of astonishing. I haven't figured it out yet. So did any of you get on an airplane to get here? Where'd you come from?
Pennsylvania.
Ooh. Everyone else from here? Somebody drive to get here?
Yeah.
Where from? Rochester. Where?
To live. Chicago.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
St. Cloud, Minnesota.
All right.
Madison, Wisconsin.
Yes.
Iowa, Iowa City.
Hi. Anybody else?
Kipping.
I'm in the heartland. It's fabulous. Well, thank you all for coming. The rest of you are from here, right? In some locale. What a funny coincidence. It's like, so is my hotel. It's really amazing. What planet? But it is a great delight to be here. It's a great delight to be having like this concentrated period on loving kindness as a quality and as a meditation. And we're going to have the opportunity to explore it as a practice, which is the most important thing, really. I think that you leave with a greater sense of, as I said last night, confidence and clarity, should you wish to pursue that practice once you're gone. And so I'll speak, of course. We'll do both sitting and walking practice. We'll have a lot of time for questions. And we'll just have fun in its own particular way. We have lots of breaks. It's very nice. and we really will. We'll have fun in its own different sort of way. How many of you have done loving kindness meditation before? How many have not? Is there anybody who's not done any kind of meditation before? Okay. So there are lots of ways of describing this. One way is to say that, of course, there are many styles and there are many different methods of meditation, and there are ways in which a particular practice doesn't only develop one thing, but it might emphasize that one thing, that one quality or a particular approach to having a better life, to being happier. There are all kinds of practices that are basically centered on the development of mindfulness, trying to pay more attention in a more realistic way, a more truthful way to our experience, so that we understand our lives more, so that we are moving through life with a greater sense of insight. So the whole nature of those practices is in some ways to see what we might be adding on to the present moment in a way that tends to distort it. You know, we have a flash of a certain emotion and maybe we have the habit of grabbing it and saying, I'm going to be this way forever, right? Or I shouldn't be feeling this. I've been meditating so long now, why is it still here? There are all kinds of different ways we might be habituated to react. So that whole scope of practice, those ways of practice are centered around spotting those tendencies, seeing if we can loosen their grip. It's not that they won't arise, but we don't have to be so embroiled in them. See if we can loosen the grip of those habits of mind and see more clearly what our experience actually is. So let's take the example of physical pain. If we're working in that particular way, really emphasizing mindfulness, then the first thing we would want to see is what we might be adding on to that experience. And this is certainly something that's very common. I knew it very deeply. Like, what's it going to feel like in a week? What's it going to feel like in a month? What's it going to feel like in a year? I very much have that habit of taking the present moment's worth of difficulty and adding on top of it all of that anticipated difficulty, feeling just overwhelmed and defeated and giving up. That's not to say the present moment's dose of pain is necessarily easy, but it's very different than adding on all of that future, right? So the first thing we might try to do is to see if we can loosen the grip of that kind of tendency of projecting into the future. And then we take a look at the pain as it actually is. We also see in that moment that it's not just one thing. It's moments of burning, moments of stretching, moments of pressure. Now, none of that sounds good, none of that feels good, but that's an alive system, right? Compared to something that seems so congealed and oppressive and unchanging. So, as I said last night, if somebody handed me a menu on my way in here and said, would you rather come to a deeper sense of the nature of change by looking at bliss or looking at pain, I'd say, bliss. But since no one, as of yet, has handed me a menu, we can get to some very deep understandings about the nature of life looking at the pain. Right? We see right into our experience to see some fundamental truths. So that's like a whole range of styles of meditation that are centered on mindfulness, leading to insight or wisdom, that give us a different sense of life, where our happiness lies. You know, sometimes those things we think are like so joyful, we take a good look and we go, ooh, look at that. Not so happy. Or we understand the nature of certain kinds of feelings. It's like, I do live in Massachusetts. I have a sublet apartment in New York City. I just moved to a different one. I've been shopping for furniture, so I looked at this rug. I thought, beautiful rug. Right? My whole sense of what was happening in this room became the rug, which is a little narrow. Right? So, we see that, you know, we see, oh, look at that. That's what wanting does, that kind of state. It's not condemning it or anything, it's just like, look at the nature of that state. Isn't that interesting? I thought being focused on revenge was making me strong. But look at that. What is it? You know, so we use awareness leading to insight for a real transformation of our priorities, of our understanding, and so on. One of the things we see as we look, one of the great insights that is said to come from mindfulness is this truth of connection or interconnection. It's seeing that life is just like that. It's not something romantic or sentimental or beautiful or awful. It just is. That our lives are interconnected. Also, as I said last night, one of the things I'm so interested in our time, the time we live in, is that it doesn't take a kind of specifically spiritual understanding to get there. We see that through economics. We see that through environmental awareness, that what happens over there doesn't kind of nicely stay tucked over there. It ripples out over here. And what we do, it matters. Because that too ripples out. So many things in our world point to the fact that our construct of a very separate self and other and us and them is a construct. That we influence one another, we affect one another, every one of us lives as part of a network. So the story I usually tell about that is, actually it's very much involved the co-author of my most recent book, which is Bob Thurman. The book that's not here. It's okay. It's barely out, called Love Your Enemies. Bob is a professor of Buddhist studies at Columbia University, and we're friends, and we, upon occasion, teach together, which is always great fun. So there's this example that Bob uses quite a lot in his teaching, and I really liked it, so I use it even more. And that is, it's both very Bob and very New York. He said, imagine you're on a subway, and these Martians come, and they zap the subway car so that those of you who are in the subway car are going to be together forever. He says, what do? If somebody's hungry, you feed them. If somebody's freaking out, you try to calm them down. Not because you necessarily like them or you approve of them, but because you're going to be together forever. Your lives have something to do with one another. So I just love that example, and I use it really all the time. So the second part of the story is some years ago, I can't remember exactly the year, I was flying from New York City to Tucson, and the Dalai Lama was going to be speaking in Tucson for several days, and I was going a little bit early because I was going to give a talk before the Dalai Lama himself arrived. So I ended up sitting on this airplane on the tarmac in a New York City airport for about four and a half hours in what, looking back, I now sometimes call the breakdown of civilization. Because it got hotter and hotter and hotter and hotter. People were yelling and screaming, get me off this airplane. Now, you know, I hear like 9 hours, 10 hours, you think, oh my God, that was bad enough. And I wasn't feeling that chipper myself, you know, I was like, I couldn't reach the people in Tucson who were supposed to pick me up, so I was concerned about that. And I kept thinking, you know, I'm paying rent in New York City, which is not cheap. And, you know, if they'd only let me off this airplane, I could go home and I could start again tomorrow. But no one, at one point, you know, the pilot got on the PA system. He's like, no one's getting off this aircraft. Okay. So I was not feeling that great. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, that image that Bob used, that I use so much more often, came up in my mind. Imagine you're on a subway, and these Martians come, and they zap the subway car so that those of you who are in there are going to be together forever. And I looked around the airplane, and I thought, maybe these are my people. And it was interesting, the shift, you know, because I realized a lot of my ire was centered around, how long am I going to be stuck with you? Yelling and screaming, and then I thought, forever. Okay, deal with this. Deal with this in a different way. That's kind of the sensibility. It didn't mean I invited anyone home with me, or that I actually preferred sitting on that airplane. But it was more of like a we, right? Consciousness. Which is also true. You know, Bob's image is not just fanciful. Our lives really do have something to do with one another. Our actions are very consequential in that way. We live in an interconnected universe. The Vietnamese Zen teacher, Thich Nhat Hanh, is famous for these kinds of reflections. He'll hold up like a string bean and say, now see the world, because you can. The sunlight, the soil, all of the conditions that went into the the planting and the growth, the harvesting, the transporting of that string bean, the hopes and dreams of the farmer, all the conditions of their life, and on and on and on and on. That's the string bean. It's life itself. We all live as part of a network, a matrix. However alone or separate or cut off we might feel, we are still part of this greater whole. So the lived expression of that is this quality called loving kindness, which is confusing. First of all, it's a confusing word because it's not that common a word. You wouldn't necessarily, you know, be in a cafe here and overhear the conversation at the next table and have somebody be using the word loving kindness occasionally. But it depends on where you are. But it's not a word that we might use. And so my concern is that that might then make the quality itself seem somewhat arcane and separate from day-to-day life and precious in the negative sense of the word. The word in Pali, the language of the original Buddhist text that loving-kindness is the common translation of, is metta, M-E-T-T-A. Sometimes it's translated, although less commonly, it's translated as love. But that also can be very confusing for us, right? Because how many different things do we mean when we say love? It could be so many. Sometimes we say love and it really, frankly, is a medium of exchange. You know, I will love you as long as you love me in return, as long as the following 15 conditions are met. Once I used that example in a room full of people and someone called out, only 15? You know, so I will love you as long as however many conditions are met. I will love myself as long as I never make a mistake. You know, and that's not, that's a familiar state, but it's not really what we mean by metta, because clearly it's so breakable. It's so fragile. I mean, think about that. I will love myself as long as I never make a mistake. So how long is that going to last? So metta, as a word, is what we explore in exploring the nature of this kind of connection and how it can mean not liking everybody, not approving of everybody, but having this deep, deep sense that our lives have something to do with one another. For a while, I had hoped that the word metta itself would enter the culture, as you know, some words do. I had a brief spurt of hope some years ago, it must have been like 15 years ago, when Alice Walker, the writer, was interviewed in the New York Times, and she talked about her meditation practice, and they asked her what she did, and she said, "I do metta," and I thought, okay, now everyone's going to say metta, and of course nobody said metta, so that didn't work. And then, what was it, like 2 years ago, L.A. Laker basketball player Ron Artest, first he filled out the paperwork to officially change his name to Metta World Peace, say Metta, M-E-T-T-A. And so there was this brief flurry of media interest, like, what is Metta? And then, I don't know, like 6 months later or something, the paperwork was approved, and he officially changed his name, and so again, there was this brief flurry, and so I've been keeping an eye on him, and I guess last season he had some problems, and he behaved badly in some way. So my friends kept sending me these headlines that said things like, real headlines, said things like, "Metta gone wrong." You know, "Metta fails." Things like that. But I still have a lot of hope for him. You know, so I've come to see that it is extremely unlikely that the word metta itself will enter the culture. But the most important thing is our inner sense of it, what it means, what it doesn't mean, that feeling, the flavor, the texture, when we're coming from that place of honoring the sense of connection. So that's one whole side of things. And maybe we'll do sitting now. You might just want to stretch. Doing the foundational technique, not yet loving kindness, but the kinds of mindfulness practice that is the foundation of developing this sort of insight. So this is just reinforcing the same skill set that we're then going to take with us into doing loving kindness practice itself. And so I'd like to invite you to do a meditation, which I'll guide, of settling your attention on the feeling of the breath, the actual sensations of the breath. And also invite you to pay particular attention to how you are, how you speak to yourself, when you realize you've been distracted from the breath. You're emerging from a fantasy, memory, judgment, or you're waking up after falling asleep. It happens. You know, how are you in that moment where the guidance actually is to gently let go without judgment and bring your attention back to the feeling of the breath? Because that's not easy for us in general. That's why it's such a potent form of practice. Settle your attention on the feeling of the breath. You realize, however long it's been, that you've just been completely gone. It's been quite some time since you last felt a breath. How are you in that moment? Okay, so you can sit comfortably, see if your back can be straight without being strained or overarched, and you can close your eyes or not. However you feel most at ease. Sometimes we start actually by listening to sound, whether it's the sound of my voice or other sounds. Even though we like certain sounds and we don't like others. We can allow them to arise and pass away. And bring your attention to the feeling of your body sitting, whatever sensations you discover. bring your attention to your hands. And see if you can make the shift from the more conceptual level, like oh, fingers, to the world of direct sensation. You're pulsing, throbbing, pressure. You don't have to name these things, but feel them. And bring your attention to the feeling of your breath. In this system, it's just the normal, natural breath. You don't have to try to make it deeper or different. Just be with it however it's appearing and however it's changing. You can rest your attention on the feeling of the breath. See if you can be with just one breath. Without concern for what's already gone by, without leaning forward for even the very next breath, just this one. If images or sounds or sensations or emotions should arise, but they're not all that strong, if you can still stay connected to the feeling of the breath, just let them flow on by. You're breathing. It's just one breath. If something comes up that's strong enough to really pull you away, and you do get lost, pay really careful attention to that moment when you realize you've been gone. Because that's the crucial moment. That's the transforming moment. That's the moment we have the chance to be really different. So instead of judging yourself or blaming yourself or condemning yourself, see if you can gently let go of whatever and shepherd your attention back to the feeling of the breath. If you find you have to let go and begin again, like a billion times in the next few minutes, it's fine. That's actually the practice. Okay, it's often an interesting exercise, isn't it? That inner voice. So the literal meaning of the word metta is friendship. It means developing the art of friendship, first of all, toward ourselves, and toward others, finally all beings, all of life. It's very much that sensibility of acknowledging connection. It can be born of insight, which is born of awareness. It's a pretty straight trajectory. We enhance mindfulness to see more clearly. What we see is how connected we are. And the response of the heart to that knowing is the metta, is the loving kindness. There are also, and this is what we're going to emphasize in our time here together, there's like a whole stream of other ways of doing meditation practice, which are not so emphasizing using mindfulness to see more clearly, to have insight, and so on, but are really about what I sometimes call the stretch. You know, it's realizing that we have certain habits, we can be in a rut in the way we perceive things, in the way we even see things, and we willingly, intentionally move our attention, we play with our attention so that we're seeing things from a different angle. Not a phony angle. We're not trying to be pretentious or hypocritical or act like we feel something we really don't feel or judge what is genuinely going on. But it's a stretch. It's an experiment. It's all about an experiment in awareness and attention. So, for example, as I used, I think, last night, let's say you're the kind of person who pretty well comes to the end of the day and tends to evaluate yourself. Like, how'd I do today? And let's just say you're the kind of person in doing that who pretty well only remembers the mistakes you made today. And the things you didn't say quite right, and the ways you now have some regret, or that really stupid thing you said at lunch at the meeting, let's just say. So much so that your whole sense of who you are and all that you will ever be just collapses around that really stupid thing you said at lunch at the meeting. The stretch, the process of deepening loving kindness is almost like asking yourself, anything else happened today? Like anything good. But it's not phony, it's not pretentious, it's not like insisting, oh, wasn't that a brilliant and witty thing I said at lunch at that meeting? Maybe it was really stupid. And there are consequences to that. But that's not all that we are, ever. So it's that collapse, that fixedness of view, that rigidity, that narrowness, that's what we're challenging by moving our attention somewhere else. Anything good within me? And again, it's not to deny or annihilate what's gone wrong, but we can be so fixed there. It's such a habit. Like, let's see what happens when we give a little airtime to the other. And so that is actually my favorite thing to say about loving kindness practice is, what happens? What happens when I look for the good within me? Instead of only focusing on what's negative. It reminds me, in many ways, of what is getting to be more and more popular these days, which is a gratitude practice. You know, people say, researchers say, that one of the most powerful healing things we can do for happiness is just to keep a gratitude journal. At the end of the day, to write down three things you're grateful for. And I always say one of them could be that you're breathing. You know, it doesn't have to be something grandiose. But I would also say, I don't know if this is your experience or not, but both through my personal conditioning, my cultural conditioning, this is not my automatic tendency at the end of the day. I'm much more likely to come to the end of the day and think about three things I can complain about. You know, that person was late, the airplane, God knows. You know, that's just a conditioning. It's a very New York thing, we might say, in many ways. In fact, somebody, I was teaching somewhere and somebody was trying to teach us jokes. So this is a joke, this is my only joke. And I'm not going to do very well, but it's something like, it's a New York City restaurant, and this group of women is sitting at the table, and the waiter comes up to them and says, "Is anything all right?" In contrast to, "Is everything all right?" Right? So that's a conditioning, and it's very much mine. So for me to come to the end of the day and say, okay, I'm going to write down three things I'm grateful for, is a stretch. It's an intentional act. It's not violent. It's not pretending everything was totally great. I couldn't be happier that the airline lost my luggage. I shouldn't say that because they didn't, but I'm getting onto the plane on Monday. You know, we're not happy that the airline lost our luggage, but it's not the only thing in that day, right? So we're willing to include elements of our experience that we normally exclude. That's why it takes intentionality, but not kind of forceful, phony, coerced intentionality. It's really, it's kind of fun. That's the fun part. To experiment. And even just to see, look at all that happens when I look for the good. I don't like doing that for myself. I don't even much like doing it for others. But we can laugh at our own reactions and check it out. So one of the preliminary exercises for loving-kindness practice is to look for the good, whether with ourselves or others. And again, this is not meant to be denial and pretending everything is just so wonderful when maybe it's really not. But if we obsess about, say, someone's faults, it's all we think about, and we go over that list, same list, again and again and again, of all their faults and all their problems, we will naturally feel more and more alienated from them. There's going to be a big gulf of self and other out there. Whereas if we can find one good thing about them, and it might be small, we actually feel a different kind of connection. And with that connection, we can honestly and directly look at what's wrong or what's difficult. But it's a different vantage point. Instead of them being kind of the other way out there, it's just more of a sense of connection as we look directly at what's wrong. So I went to Burma in 1985 to do an intensive period of loving-kindness practice for about 3 months. And this was one of the first exercises that was suggested to me as a platform for getting into the loving-kindness meditation. Intentionally see if you can find one good thing about someone, and sometimes you can't. I'll get into that in a minute. But so I went back to my room, and I actually thought of somebody I was finding tremendously irritating, I think in a very reasonable way. And then I had a memory where I had been there when this person I found irritating had done this beautiful, kind, generous thing for someone we both know. He just did a very kind act. And he did it in the best way possible, so she didn't feel like pitied or condescended to or anything. He just did it so well. And that memory came up in my mind, and I thought, I don't want to think about that. That's too complicated. I liked it better. It was simpler when it was all bad all the time. Right? But life is complicated. And that's why you have to be able to laugh at yourself as you see these reactions. We stretch. We make the experiment. What's it like to look for the good in someone? And in truth, sometimes we cannot find it, or it's just not right. It's too hard. And then there's another reflection that's done, which is this somewhat simple assertion on the part of the Buddha. You can check it out to see if you think it's true, which is that everybody wants to be happy. Everybody wants to be happy. We all want a sense of belonging, a sense of place in our bodies and our minds. We want to feel connected to something larger than our limited sense of who we are. We all want to be happy. And the main problem is ignorance. It's not really having much of a sense where real happiness is to be found. We're taught so much, and there's so much conditioning. We're so confused, and if only I had this rug, then I'd be happy. You know, I'd be even happy if someone shipped it. That's a joke. Don't hit me, but... I'll give you my address just in case. You know, I want the rug, but I don't want the hassle of getting it on the airplane, you know, so now I want the rug and the shipping. And, you know, then I'll be happy. I mean, that's the kind of thing we tend to believe. Or, you know, maybe I can steal the rug, no one will notice. It doesn't matter who I hurt, as long as I get the rug. Because that's where real happiness is to be found. And, you know, we can get so confused. Anybody can get so confused about what will actually make us happy, what will actually make us strong. And so that's the problem. But everybody actually wants to be happy. The problem is ignorance. It's confusion, conditioning. So that's another reflection that's sometimes done. It's a stretch to remember or to recall, if it seems right to us, in all kinds of different situations. So the whole range of loving-kindness practices, when it's used as a kind of distinct methodology, has to do with that kind of experimentation. I'm used to paying attention in this way. I'm going to try to see what happens when I pay attention in that way. It takes intentionality. It takes some flexibility. It can really take a playful spirit to move out of that more familiar rut. It's a willingness to take some risks with our awareness. At no time is the practice of loving kindness as a methodology about trying to force yourself to feel something that's not there. It's really the flexibility all has to do with how we're paying attention. So the first question we ask is, how are we paying attention? How present are we? How fragmented are we? If you're in a conversation with somebody and you're really not listening, you're thinking about the 50 emails you have to write, the experiment is to see what happens if I really gather my attention, just like we did around the breath right now. What happens if I gather my attention and I'm fully present? That in itself is like an act of loving kindness. And it's received, I think, in that way. I often tell a story about many years ago, when I was living in India, a friend of mine went off to Sikkim to see this very great Tibetan Lama. At that point, it was the 16th Karmapa, this is titled, and who was extremely renowned and eminent and very, very powerful Tibetan teacher. And my friend came back and said that the Karmapa greeted him as though his appearance there was just about the most important thing that had ever happened to the Karmapa in his life. which I would wager it was not. And my friend said the Karmapa gave him that impression, not through great pomp and circumstance or grandiose gestures. He gave him that impression by paying absolute, complete attention to him. Which my friend said, the subjective experience was one of feeling completely loved. Just from how totally there he was. So we look at the quality of our attention. Can we gather? Can we really arrive? That's the first experiment. And then what do we pay attention to? Like in that example I just used, if we're thinking about our day, do we pretty well fixate on what went wrong, what we didn't do right, and what we don't like about how we acted? Not to ignore that, we need to acknowledge that, but that's not the whole picture. Can we include the more positive, uplifting side of things as well? That's part of the experiment. And then, of course, in the context of loving kindness, who do we pay attention to? Who do we disregard? Who doesn't count in our eyes? Not even through antipathy or prejudice, but just indifference. Who is the other? And we work to include rather than exclude. Again, none of this means you're going to take everyone home with you. But what's happening in our hearts? Does everybody count? I go, as I said last night, I go to Washington, D.C. about once a month to teach, and occasionally I go more than that, where I do things like this, a non-residential weekend or a day long, and there used to be a facility. They've since torn it down. That was the common place that we rented for those events. And it was an elementary school in Maryland. And all along the walls of the Carters, they had put up the school's rules of kindness. So whenever it was time to do walking meditation, we'd like all stand there and read the rules of kindness because they were so cool. They were really great. And they included things like, don't hurt anyone on the inside or on the outside. And my very favorite rule of kindness was, everybody gets to play. Everybody gets to play. It's not that everyone will be your best friend, but everybody gets to play. So who do we pay attention to? Who do we objectify? Who do we discount? What happens when we work to include rather than exclude? When we look at someone instead of through them. Or when we admit the complexity of life, like that person I found so irritating. What happens when we more behold them and realize, oh yeah, life is complicated, isn't it? So many facets and conditions and aspects and within ourselves, within others. That's really the process of developing loving kindness. It's a stretch. It's a grand experiment, a very creative experiment with our lives, with our minds, with our hearts. But nowhere is there this dictum like you must feel A, B, and C. That the correct response to that practice is, you know, if not by the end of the day today, then certainly by the end of the day tomorrow. You will love yourself completely. You'll have forgiven 15 people. You stop at the pet store to buy a new pet. Maybe you do, but you know, it's not that useful to have that kind of expectation. because it's really not about that. It's not so quantifiable, the results, the progress, the measure. It's kind of immeasurable in some ways. Over time, if you do a practice like loving kindness practice, you will definitely experience change. But you may not, first of all, you may not see it in your formal practice period. It may not be. You can say at 11:15, I loved myself completely. You know, it's not like that. But you will see a difference in your life. It's almost like my signature story of doing loving kindness practice. I had learned, I'd heard about it in my first retreat in January of 1971, where it was done almost as a kind of ceremonial closing to the end of the retreat, but I didn't really have a grasp of kind of a systematic way of doing it, and certainly not in a guided way. But I was intrigued by it. I really wanted to learn how to do it in a more systematic way. And so I read some things, and I saw that in the classical unfolding of that particular kind of practice, you start with the extension of loving kindness to yourself, and then you move on to these different categories of beings, those who you feel close to, those whom you don't know that well, and so on, until you come to all beings everywhere. So I had a sense of the lay of the land, although I never really had a chance at that point to do it. And then we opened the Insight Meditation Society in 1976, and we didn't have any programming scheduled for the first month. So those of us who were there decided, okay, we'll do a retreat for the first month. And I thought, okay, I've got a month, I'll do loving kindness practice. So even though I didn't have a teacher to guide me at the time, I knew the lay of the land. So I knew you started with yourself, and I spent the first week just doing loving-kindness practice for myself. So all day long, I was silently repeating these phrases, like, may I be happy, may I be peaceful. And I felt absolutely nothing. It was like a completely dreary week. And then at the end of the week, something happened to one of our friends in sort of our larger community in Boston. So several of us had to suddenly leave the retreat. I was up in one of the bathrooms getting ready to go when I dropped this big jar of something, and it just like went down on the tile floor, and the jar broke, it shattered, and the stuff went everywhere. And I noticed the very first thought that came up in my mind was, you are really a klutz, but I love you. And I thought, look at that. You could have given me anything in the course of that week, and I could not have honestly said something was happening, but something was happening. So in undertaking a practice like this, I know it's difficult, but if we could suspend that habit of like constant judgment and assessment and just give it a shot, make the experiment for whatever period of time seems reasonable to you, a month, 3 months, whatever you want to do, a week. A week's probably a little short. And then see if it's making some kind of difference in your life. But don't necessarily look at that formal period. Let's say you're sitting 20 minutes a day every morning, something like that. That may not be where it's really striking. It may be when you drop something, how you speak to yourself when you need to begin again, how you meet a stranger. Things like that. That's the place where it really flourishes. So one of the most important understandings is that it is like an experiment. We're just going to do it and see what happens. And it's a stretch. It means not necessarily looking at ourselves or at others the ways we have been accustomed to. But it also can be fun. If you don't have this driven sense of like, I've got to accomplish it by tomorrow, but rather come into that sense of a rhythm, of a slower, perhaps, unfolding that's very deep and very real of this kind of transformation. So we have both kinds of practice. We have the practices that center us in the moment and help us see more clearly. We have the practices that are an experimentation, like the gratitude practice or loving-kindness practice as a method, where we're moving out of our particular comfort zone or what we're accustomed to, and we're paying attention in a different way. I think in terms of loving-kindness, and one of the best examples I know, actually, is what happens, what we see evolve over time when we do loving kindness for what is called a neutral person. Some people are not crazy about that particular aspect of the practice. It's really my favorite one because I think it exemplifies the very nature of loving kindness practice. A neutral person is someone we don't particularly like or dislike. We just feel kind of neutral toward them. And what happens is that we are, in effect, paying attention to this person, whereas our automatic tendency might be to just ignore them. But by bringing them into our meditation, in effect, holding them in our heart, wishing them well, offering the phrases to them as the vehicle for that well-wishing, then we're not looking through them, we're looking at them. And it's fascinating to see the change. Sometimes in a longer-term intensive retreat, they suggest that you choose as a neutral person someone in the room, because you'll just tend to run into them now and again, and you'll tend to see the evolution of your sense of connection. Or if not that, then maybe someone in your life, your ordinary life, that you tend to see now and then who plays some function in your life, like checkout person in the supermarket, dry cleaner. Of course, I have that dry cleaner story, which I'll tell in a second. Somebody that you don't relate to much, positive or negative, but they're there. And seeing what happens in that evolution over time. So I do have a friend who's... I teach an intensive loving-kindness retreat every year in Barry at the Insight Meditation Society in February, which I brought that up when I was on Maui. Not that many people wanted to come, but I feel freer here to say. It's February, Massachusetts.
Tropical,
yes. Come to balmy Massachusetts. We go through the course in that 7 days. We go through beginning with ourselves and all these different categories, ending with all beings. So I have a friend who many years ago sat that retreat, and then I didn't see her again for about 6 months. I saw her at another retreat I was teaching, and she came up to me at that second retreat 6 months later, and she was all kind of beaming and shiny, and she said, "I've fallen in love with my dry cleaner." And I sort of knew her life and her history and knew that she wanted to start dating again. And so I was all excited, and she could tell what I was thinking from my face. And then she said, no, not romantically, but he was my neutral person back in that metta retreat I did 6 months ago. And she said, "Now every day when I meditate, I hold him in my heart and I wish him well." And she said, "Now I go into the store and it's different." She said, "I want to know how he's doing. Is everything okay? It's like he's one of mine, right?" And one assumes he was a perfectly fine dry cleaner. It wasn't because she felt obligated to in returning a favor. It wasn't because he was such a huge challenge that her sense of freedom rested in having a different relationship to him. It's just because she was paying attention to him rather than just objectifying him. So a couple of years went by, I hadn't seen her, and then I was asked by this magazine to write an article on loving kindness, and I happened to run into her, and I said, well, do you mind if I use your name and tell your story? And she said, no. And she said, you know, I still go into that store, and I still have that feeling, like, how are you? You know, everything okay? So I wrote the article, and, you know, a long time went by, I hadn't seen her, and then I ran to her again. And I said, how's your dry cleaner? And she said, you know, I still go into that store, and I still have that feeling. She said, I've moved on to the UPS person. And I thought, how cool is that? You know, but I love that sense because it just points to this is what the engine of the practice is. It's how we're paying attention. It's not sitting there thinking, I must make myself feel X, Y, and Z for my dry cleaner. But because we change the way we're paying attention as an emergent property, that sense of connection will come about. And so that's really the nature of the practice that we're going to emphasize in our time here together as we go through the rest of today and through tomorrow.